Well, good morning. We've been going through the book of Luke, so we'll be back there in chapter 8. Luke chapter 8. You remember last Sunday, we talked just a little bit about, as we go through the book of Luke, we're going to see just little two verses here about a subject, five verses here about a subject, 16 about a subject, but a lot of times we will lump some of these together because some of them are not very long. Last week we did that, and this week we're going to be doing it as well. We're going to be looking at verses 19 through 25. So Luke chapter 8, verses 19 to 25. We'll begin by reading our text. It says, then came to Jesus, his mother and his brothers, and could not come at him for the press, or over for the crowd. There was a multitude of people crowding in around Jesus, and it appears his parents or his mother and brothers came to see him and couldn't get through. So they sent word to him by the people in front of them or whoever that they were there, would like to see him. Verse 20, and it was told him by certain which said, thy mother and thy brothers stand without, desiring to see thee. And he answered and said unto them, my mother and my brothers are these which hear the word of God and do it. So there's those three verses. And then we go on, verse 22. And it came to pass on a certain day that he went into a ship with his disciples, and he said unto them, let us go over unto the other side of the lake. And they launched forth. But as they sailed, he fell asleep, and there came down a storm of wind on the lake, and they were filled with water and were in jeopardy. They came to him and awoke him, saying, Master, Master, we perish. Then he arose and rebuked the wind and the raging of the water, and they ceased, and there was a calm. And he said unto them, where is your faith? And they, being afraid, wondered, saying one to another, what manner of man is this? For he commandeth even the winds and the water, and they obey him. We'll stop there for this morning. You see, I've entitled, if you've got an outline, I hope that you do. You may not have had enough passed out. If you don't have one, catch your neighbor not looking and swipe theirs. All right? I've entitled the message, what kind of man is this? And we'll have 2 points that will finish that question. The first one is this, what kind of man is this that he would be so disrespectful of his mother? When we read those three verses, and you can see I've got them, they're also found in Matthew chapter 12, you can see they're on the outline in Mark chapter 3, as well as here in Luke. When we first read them, it sounds like, and most people, the vast majority of people would read this and say, gosh, you know, why is he talking like this about his mother? He said, your mother wants to see you. And he says, who is my mother? You can read the other Matthew and Mark account and say it. And he poses that question as if, and what we hear sometimes if we're not careful is, who cares? So my mother's there. Who is my mother? I don't want to have anything to do with her. What do I care? I don't want to see my brothers. Sometimes we hear that. It definitely doesn't say that, does it? But sometimes we hear it, and people who are skeptical and looking for something wrong in the Scriptures will latch on to that. Have you ever known anyone that's just looking for something wrong with the Bible? All right, maybe you were one at some point. You're looking for something to find fault with the Scriptures, and this is one of those things. No matter how insignificant it may seem, they latch on to that. And I want to talk about that just for a little bit. Is dishonoring your parents a sin? Yes, it is. All right, it doesn't matter who your parents were. Your parents may not have been perfect. My children's parents weren't perfect. At least not their dad. Some of your parents may have been horrible, disgusting. But somehow, you are obligated to honor them. It doesn't mean you're obligated to obey them. But it doesn't matter you're obligated to enable them or whatever the case may be. But you are obligated to honor them. Dishonoring your parents is a violation of the fifth commandment. Honor your father and mother. Scriptures tell us in the New Testament that's the first commandment with a promise that your days may be long upon the earth. So, dishonoring your parents is a sin. Was Jesus a sinner?
No.
Did Jesus ever sin?
No.
I've got some verses there that you can look those up and see what those verses say about Jesus being pure and without blemish, etc. There's one I want to look at in John chapter 8, verse 46. Or Jesus, if you want to turn there if you like, I won't be honing in there for very long, but Jesus is talking to a group of people, and they are accusing him, if I remember right, of being a child of Beelzebub or of the devil. And in John chapter 8, verse 46, he says this. He asks a question. Which of you convinceth me or convicts me of sin? Now that's a question. Which of you can demonstrate before us all that I'm a sinner? Have you ever thought about the arrogance of someone even asking such a question? If I were to seriously of myself ask you that question right now, who here can convict me of being a sinner? Who can demonstrate that I have sinned? Who can prove, give an example, that I have sinned? You can't help your response. What every person in this room did when I asked that question was rehearsed in your mind what you know about who? Me. All right? Now, half of you don't know me from Adam. So you may not know. But if you were to guess, you probably all would guess he's a sinner. Those of you who are in this church, have been in this church with me for 20 some odd years, you're rehearsing things that you have seen me do or say or whatever over the last 20 years. And some of them don't come out just well. Some of them might would qualify. If you're my wife or my 39-year-old son, you could start writing a long list of things. I remember years ago a guy came to my house. We were talking about church and talking about salvation and stuff, and he told me that he had been saved in his, at that time, was like 40 years. He was an old man. And that when he got saved, he never sinned. And I said, how long have you been saved? 40 years. I said, you've never sinned. He said, no. And I told him, I said, love you. What I need to do is talk to your wife. Because I'm pretty sure if she were honest, she'd have a different opinion about that. But here is Jesus of Nazareth standing before them and asking them, almost daring them, to find something wrong with him, to find a sin. With anyone else, that would be insane. But with the perfect, sinless Son of God, it's a legitimate question, isn't it? Which of you convicts me of sin? 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, for he, God, has made him, Jesus, to be sin for us who knew no sin. God's made Jesus to be sin for us. He, Jesus, the one who knew no sin, so that the righteousness of God may be found in us. Hebrews 4:15, where the writer says that Christ was tempted and tested in every point that we might be tempted to test it in principle or whatever, yet, what? Without sin. 1 Peter, there's three verses there. You can look them up where it talks about Jesus being the incorruptible, unstained, unblemished. When he was reviled, he reviled not again. No guile was found in him whatsoever. So we can see from the Scriptures that the Scriptures claim that Jesus was sinless. Jesus had no sin. They claim that the Scriptures, in the Scriptures, Jesus claims that he had no sin. And yet we read our text for today and we see this little thing where it seems like Jesus is being rude. Jesus is being disrespectful of his own mother and his brothers. And people latch on to that and say, yeah, here's an example where Jesus sinned, dishonoring his parents. And they do so in the face of the Scriptures, which tell us he did no sin. Now, who are we to believe? It seems to me that there is an extreme arrogance. You need to think about this because we come on the verge of being guilty of this ourselves, if not guilty of it. An arrogance about thinking that I, 2,000 years removed from when this text was written, our text for this morning was given, 2,000 years removed, I've got one or two sentences to base my judgment on, and I come to the conclusion, as a lot of these unbelievers do, that Jesus is a sinner based on these two verses stacked against the other verses that declare he is not a sinner. The arrogance that it takes to believe that I have better judgment. In fact, my judgment is so good about Jesus that I can declare those verses that declare Jesus as a sinner are wrong. Be careful that you understand who Jesus was. Now, so if that's not saying, if he's not being rude, then what is he saying? Sometimes, there was an instance also found in the book of Mark, chapter 3, where we see a little tidbit of information where Jesus' family and friends try to come to him and try to get close to him enough that they can take him. And it looks like they're wanting to put him in, if they didn't have an insane asylum, they thought he was crazy, they thought he was a mental case. And they wanted to for his own sake, to get him out, to get him back, to put him in a safe place. Jesus himself said in Matthew chapter 10, "Don't think that I came to bring peace. I didn't come to bring peace, but a sword." But a sword. Because he goes on to say, there will be cases where, and this is my paraphrase, where a father will be set against his children, and a son will be set against his father and against his mother. And they will be at enmity one with another, and there will be no peace because they are following me. Sometimes, in fact, I would venture to say probably the most of the time in all of a Christian's life, their closest Christian friends, those with whom they have the most and the richest fellowship, are not their family. All of my adult life as a Christian, the people that I was closest to in the faith, the people that I shared my faith with the most never has been my family. And it's not because my family are wicked people. They go to church every Sunday. They're, it appears to be, committed to their faith. But there is just something about our values, our interest, whatever it is, that has never caused us to be that close spiritually. Some of you that I have known for 20 years here have, perhaps we might say, better reasons than that to not be close to your family. And I understand that. I get that. And I think that's what Jesus is saying here. He says, look around you. Who do you see here with me? Who is it that I spend every day with? Who is it that we are walking in this life together and they are following me? I tell you, those are my brothers. Those are my real sisters. Those are my real mothers. Sometimes, that's the last point on there, for the sake of our spiritual lives, sometimes for the sake of my mental thinking, my emotional thinking, sometimes we have to distance ourselves from our own blood kin. You have to do it. And they will, let me tell you, for the most part, they will never understand that. Years ago, I heard a sermon. And it was talking about the passage that I kind of alluded to a while ago. It said, unless a man hates his father and mother, he loves me more than his father and brother, or unless he hates his father and mother, he cannot be my disciple. That's a hard thing. I don't think that means a comparative thing. I don't think he means you love me more than you love them. I don't think he means you hate them more than you hate somebody else. I think the explanation is that you are following Christ. And in your pursuit of Christ and where it takes you and what it demands of you, sometimes your family are going to think you hate them. You haven't said that, you haven't acted like that, but sometimes they're just going to think that because you're not doing the same things that you always did with them. And you can't do it. Let's go to the second one. What kind of man is this? That the winds and the seas obey him. And again, I've got the comparative passages in Matthew and Mark listed there. You can read them. They pretty much say the same thing with one tiny exception there. But let's talk for a minute about the exhaustion of the famous. I've never been famous, so I've never been exhausted from being famous, but we all can imagine, and perhaps some of you have seen it, where a well-known popular movie star or actress or actor, whatever, they can just go out in the street and all of a sudden there's 50 cameras snapping pictures. Or they can go to a restaurant and they can't even eat because of the people wanting their autograph or whatever. A famous ball player will experience something like that. And I can understand, even though I've never seen it or experienced it, I can understand where that can wear on you. That you cannot do anything without being surrounded by people pulling at you and yanking at you, wanting something. And you may find yourself trying to get away and hide. I think in a similar way, Jesus perhaps probably experienced some of that. How many times have we read in the book of Luke where he is surrounded by a multitude of people? And I think that may be one of the factors that are involved in this story, where he gets in a boat, presumably at night, and is going to cross the Sea of Galilee. And they start across, and I'm sure you have read this before, but the Sea of Galilee is 600 feet below sea level. And there are mountains on each side, and the wind can just suddenly come whirling down the mountains and the hot air mixed with the cold air and create a tremendous storm on the sea. And I don't know how much warning you have that it's coming, but there it is. And Jesus and his disciples are crossing the sea in a boat, and one of these storms comes up. And Jesus is asleep. And I think perhaps he is asleep because of that exhaustion. He has found a time to get a few hours away from all this crowd of people, and he promptly falls asleep. And he is in such a deep sleep and an exhaustive sleep that as the crossing and the storm comes up, it doesn't initially wake him up. And the sea gets so turbulent, and the boat begins to appear to be to the disciples, who were very well versed in being a fisherman, that they might not make it. It may sink. And they go and find Jesus, and they say, "Master, we're perishing. We've got a question there on the outline. Why did the disciples turn to Jesus for help?" Not a trick question. Because they were they thought they were going to die. Right? They thought they were going to die, so they turned to him for help. There's a better question. When did they turn to it? When they figured out, "I can't do nothing else. There's nothing else I can do. I've given up rowing harder or trying to turn the ship or bail the water out. There's nothing else I can do. And after I've exhausted all the things that I might could do, I turn to Jesus." That's kind of the way we live sometimes, isn't it? All right. And they turn to him. And Jesus says, you can see it in the book of Mark, it says three words. It's given as a quote: "Peace, be still." How do you think Jesus said that? Do you think there's a lot of noise going on? Do you think that the storm, that the wind is howling, that these disciples can hardly hear one another speak? I think the noise is so great, and the commotion and the chaos is so great, that they barely, maybe, can converse with one another. Does Jesus have to yell at the top of his lungs for the winds to hear him? Does he have to yell at the top of his lungs and point his finger and wave his hands at the waves? No. All Jesus has to do is calmly and quietly say, "Peace, be still." Those of us who are parents, my kids weren't this way, but sometimes parents have kids that throw tantrums. And a kid who is having a mad fit, I don't ever remember seeing one when the parents calmly said, "Johnny, be still." Then it worked. At least not the first time. Jesus says, "Peace, be still." And I believe instantly the waves stopped, the wind was gone. If it was a moonlit night, I think you could have looked at a glance across that Sea of Galilee and it looked like a mirror. Totally and perfectly still. I don't believe you probably could have heard the ship creaking from trying to get over what it had just been through. I don't think you could hear the water inside the ship running off of some boards or off of this or off of that making noise. I think it was still, deathly silent. Peace, be still. These disciples have seen Jesus raise people from the dead. They have seen Jesus heal the sick. They have seen Jesus give sight to the blind. They have seen Jesus look at this woman just a few weeks ago we saw and forgive her her sins. They have seen all of these things. And now they are in a raging storm and they are filled with fear. What would that feel like? I would be afraid, wouldn't you? To think you're about to die? I would be afraid. And suddenly, the same Jesus that they have seen perform a miracle after miracle says, "Peace, be still," and the sea is calm. The sea is a piece of glass. How do they respond? Do they jump up and do a chest bump? No. Do they jump up and hook their arms or whatever the football players do, you know, do this? Do they high-five one another? No. Do they say, "Good show, man"? No. The text in Mark says they were afraid, but now they are exceedingly afraid. Their fear does not dissipate. It increases. Are you catching this? They are more afraid now than they were before. Why is that? It's because several things, you could word it several different ways. But one thing is this. They didn't know this man near as well as they thought they did. They've seen him do all these things, and yet now they say, "What kind of man is this? What kind of man is this that the winds, he can tell the wind what to do? What kind of man is this that he can talk to the sea and it will obey him? The sea obeys him." We're not talking about him talking to another man that has a mind and a brain and can hear. He talks to the water, and the water obeys him. The winds obey him. What kind of man do we have in our ship? Who is this? They saw something about Jesus. They learned something about Jesus. They learned that this man, this Jesus, was the master of the storm. He was the master of creation. And their fear becomes great. Now, I know that we all want God to be our buddy. We want God to be our friend. We want God to love us unconditionally. And I'm glad He does. I'm glad He does. But I want you to understand something, because you won't hear this very often, probably. God is not your grandpa. All right? Me and my wife have some grandkids. There's three small ones running around here today. And we see them sometimes do something that is a portrait, that is a result that reveals their sin nature. We see them, one of them manipulate the other one. Be selfish and try to manipulate the circumstances so they get the best. We see that. We see evidence of their sinful nature. And you know what we do? We chuckle. We say, "Did you see that?" And we send them home with their mom and dad. Let me tell you, God is not like that. God is a holy God. He will not sweep your sins under the rug and remember them no more. Your sin must be dealt with. and you can never pay him and satisfy that debt. You can't. Only the sinless, perfect Son of God, who is a substitute for our sin, can change that. God is not your grandpa. He's just not. He is a holy God. He's not a genie in a bottle that you can call up to work miracles for you. If your worship of Jesus is so you can get something from him, I probably got some bad news for you. You're worshiping yourself more than you're worshiping Jesus. God is not a magician that you can call to fix everything, and then once it's fixed, you just put him in the closet, forget about him until the next emergency. No. God is the God of the universe and is worthy of your worship. He's worthy of our praise. Even if God sent me to hell, he is still worthy that I would worship him for eternity in hell. We're going to end with a verse. Matthew 10:28. Where Jesus says this, "And fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul." Do you know anyone who could kill your body but not able to kill your soul? Sure. Any of you could kill me, kill my body, but not touch my soul. You could. Anybody, intentionally or accidentally, could take our life. But all they're touching is our body. And Jesus said, in comparison, he said, don't fear that person. Don't be afraid of those kind of people. That's not the problem. Sure, they can kill you. But don't fear them. And in the last part of the sentence, what does he say? But rather, fear him. Not them. The first one is don't fear them. There's lots of people included in that them word. This one is one is singular. Rather fear him. Who is him? God, the Lord. Fear him who is able to destroy both body and soul in hell. Do you believe in God? Do you believe he is the master, the creator of this universe? Do you believe that everything that exists by his word and his creative power? Do you believe because he is the creator and the God that we are obligated to worship him, to serve him, to obey him, to do all of these things because of who he is? Not what he might do for me, but because of who he is. I think that perhaps the disciples this night in this boat got a little closer to that truth. I hope as I grow, I hope as you grow in our Christian lives that we get closer and closer to really hanging on to that and realizing that and understanding that. Let's pray.